Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll.
Hello, welcome to the first episode of Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, your reluctant host for the duration. Future episodes will hopefully feature guest co-hosts, group discussions, eventually interviews. But for now, for the first few episodes at least, you're just stuck with me. What will the podcast be about? As long as there's a guitar involved, sometimes a piano, it's fair game on this show. I love 70s rock, 70s glam rock, 70s punk, power pop, 80s metal, 80s underground stuff, 80s AOR, glam metal, early 90s indie stuff. That's mostly what this show's going to be about. All kinds of stuff like that. One caveat, I absolutely despise nu metal. So you won't be hearing anything about nu metal on this show unless it is to induce vomiting. Who am I? I'm really just a huge music fan. I've spent years collecting, gathering information, music, and I figured it's about time I share the fruits of my labor with other huge music fans. That's about it. That's what the show is going to be about. In a lot of ways, I'm going to gear the show towards obscure stuff. Just because I don't really much see the point of having a podcast where I play you a bunch of songs you've already heard or bands you already know about. Of course, some of you will have heard some of the songs, know about some of the bands. But the point of the show is going to be to expose you to stuff that maybe you haven't been exposed to before. That being said, it's not all about obscurity for me. My favorite band is Cheap Trick. My number two band is Slade, but I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and another of my favorites is Fleetwood Mac, especially Lindsey Buckingham. But for me, it all started with Kiss. I was 5 years old in 1979, and my uncle, who was 19 or 20, was a big Kiss fan, and he made me a cassette, 60-minute cassette full of Kiss songs, and my parents used to play the tape, and I'd mime the songs for them with my brother, who was about three. And my uncle, as the story goes, my uncle even asked my parents if he could take me to the Dynasty tour, but I was 5 years old, and they said no. I was Gene Simmons for Halloween that year, and I was Gene Simmons again in 1981, but I sort of lost interest in music for a while after that. My dad's a huge sports guy, and he had me into sports and collecting baseball cards for a while, but eventually I got old enough to figure out for myself where my own interest really lay, and it wasn't sports, not even close. I had a friend, Nick, it's probably about sixth grade. He had a bunch of records, including Kiss records, and I'd go to his house, and we'd just listen to records, and I just became obsessed. Back then, it was all about collecting cassette tapes, unfortunately. I wish they'd been records, but I had hundreds of cassettes, mostly metal. I spent my teen years as a metalhead. That doesn't exactly mean what you might think. I was into the poppy stuff. Still am. Def Leppard, the Pete Willis years, Dokken, Rat, Twisted Sister, Cinderella, Kix, Tesla, Great White. That kind of stuff was my favorite stuff. And as far as metal goes, that's still what I like the most, is metal with hooks, catchy heavy metal. I watched Headbangers Ball every Saturday night. I read every issue of Metal Edge magazine, and I was very into all the glam stuff as well. My vinyl collection started back then. My uncle gave me his Kiss records, and there was a record store a couple miles from my house called Record Rent, and they had this really odd policy. Well, the name of the store, Record Rent, is funny because they actually used to rent records. That's how the store started out, kind of like a Blockbuster for records. But by the time I was going there, they didn't rent records anymore. It was just your run-of-the-mill record store, but it was maybe less than 2 miles from my house. I could just ride my bike there, spend my allowance. So, and the guy who ran it had this really odd policy where if he got a record in without an inner sleeve, it was just the vinyl inside the cardboard, it was a buck, no matter what it was. This was a crazy policy, it didn't make much sense, but it was fine with me. And that's how I started my collection. I got most of like the AC/DC stuff, and I bought Rat, Def Leppard, that kind of stuff. I remember buying Sad Wings of Destiny back then. This is before I even had a record player. Probably had about 100 records before I even had a record player in the house. And then finally, eventually, I got a stereo. But my record collection really took off when I went to college. There were just record stores everywhere, and I was meeting really cool people, and my music world just exploded. I used the libraries extensively, and back then you could also find great records at thrift stores, and my collection just ballooned during college. This was pre-internet, right before the internet, at least for me. So the way it worked was, I'd read about a band or a record, or someone would tell me about it. I'd write it down in a little notebook, and then I'd just have to wait. And hopefully someday, I'd stumble on it in a record store or a thrift store. But there were plenty of record stores around, and records were cheap back then, and you really could find stuff back then. And of course, there were plenty of records that were just too hard to find, but the next big change came after college, and that was the internet. My eBay account dates back to July 1999, so that's when I really became an internet junkie. First, it was eBay. Back then, you could get great records on eBay for cheap. You still can sometimes, but back then, eBay was a lot different, and this changed everything. Of course, I became obsessed with eBay at this point. I also had lots of records I'd purchased at random over the years that suddenly I could sell on eBay, and I was pretty much breaking even on there for a while, buying and selling. A few years after I discovered eBay, I found my way into some trading circles online, and I would trade CDRs with other maniacs for rare, obscure stuff. I used to have a website with everything I had listed on there. They'd send me their lists, I'd go through their list, they'd go through mine, tell me what they wanted, I'd tell them what I wanted. I was constantly getting packages in the mail of, you know, multiple CDRs full of rare, obscure music that I never thought I'd be able to get my hands on pre-internet. I also used to contact people who were selling stuff on eBay or buying expensive stuff on eBay, rare records, and back then you could actually email the winners of the auctions on eBay. They don't let you do that anymore. And I'd ask them to send me a CDR or trade with me, and it almost always worked. So I was just amassing an archive. That's kind of the way I looked at it. My goal was, and still is, just to know about and hear everything. But if you're a huge music fan like me, you understand that as much as you think you know, there's always more. You're always finding out about more. So trading was the thing for a while. Then I discovered the blogs. People started uploading rare music to sites like Mega Upload and RapidShare and posting links on these blogs. And it got to the point that almost every obscure record you could possibly imagine wanting to hear was available on a blog. We're not talking about piracy, because we're talking about records that were out of print 40 years that you could not possibly get. And this was just a way, as a music fan, to be able to hear this music that was just impossible before the internet to hear unless you knew the right person or just, you know, were in the right place at the right time. But the problem is, after Mega Upload got taken out by the feds, a lot of these blogs are just full of dead links. Mega Upload's gone. Similar sites have folded. Other sites have cracked down. So now when you search the internet, you find links to what you want that are just dead. If you really dig, you can still usually find most things, but it's not as easy as it used to be to just find anything you wanted on these blogs. So at this point, I have about 3,000 records, but digitally on CD on my computer. It's just insane. There's a lot. So when I started thinking about actually making a podcast, I had to decide where to begin. And I guess I settled upon Power Pop as my jumping off point, just because I've been collecting records more than 20 years, scouring the bins, sharing with friends, trading, and I've amassed a pretty insane collection of Power Pop. It's gotten to the point where I've pretty much heard everything I know about, and at this point, it's just finding out about stuff I don't already know about. There is one record, one Power Pop record, that I still have not heard, that maybe somebody out there can help me out with. It's called Silly Boys Want You, and I've read about it in the Trouser Press books, and I've seen it on eBay once or twice for too much money. But I never found it on a blog to download. No one I ever traded with had it. So if anyone out there, it's an EP. It's 4 or 5 songs, I think. If anybody out there has it, wants to email it to me, rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com, that would be greatly appreciated. Silly Boys Want You, it's called. So what is power pop? Well, unlike a lot of other genres, like heavy metal or punk, where you could debate for weeks about what is or isn't metal or punk, and the labels, the genre names have been co-opted and bastardized so much that who even knows what they mean anymore? Especially generationally, there's just a completely different view on what is heavy metal or what is punk. A lot of the young metal fans today, I don't even know what they consider heavy metal and what they would say isn't heavy metal. But when it comes to power pop, we know exactly what the term means, because the man that coined the phrase, Greg Shaw, was a music historian and rock journalist who eloquently explained exactly what he meant by the term when he coined it. Who was Greg Shaw? Shaw was born and raised in San Francisco. He came of age in the 60s when rock and roll was exploding. In 1976, Shaw started a zine called Mojo Navigator. This is before Rolling Stone. Mojo Navigator interviewed Jerry Garcia, Janis Joplin, The Doors, etc. But when Rolling Stone came along doing the same thing, they kind of stole Shaw's thunder, and Mojo Navigator folded. But a couple years later, Shaw started another zine, which he called Who Put the Bomp, named after a doo-wop song. This was later shortened to just Bomp Magazine. Bomp Records, he had a record store called Bomp. In the March 1978 issue of Bomp Magazine, Shaw explains exactly what power pop is. He came up with the term power pop, and he explains what it means. There's a book about Shaw and Bomp Records that came out a few years ago, and I have a great quote here from Shaw from that book that references that 1978 issue. Shaw said, "As I saw it, the first wave of punk had already had its day by 1978 when Bomp Magazine ran a cover story proposing power pop, a hybrid style with the power and guts of punk, but drawing on a pop song tradition with wider popular appeal." Shaw traces the origins of power pop back to The Who, who had actually formed before the Beatles hit. They were contemporaries of the Beatles. They didn't come after the Beatles. The Who were already a group before the Beatles became known and successful. Shaw talks about The Who's short, catchy songs built on bright, uplifting chords, but behind it all, that explosive, violent, rebellious sound.
Much too much to bear. Your love is hard and fast. Your love will always last. If it's you I need, I've got to pay the levy. Got to pay, 'cause your love's too heavy.
Power pop formula, according to Greg Shaw, and remember, Shaw actually coined the term power pop, and the formula, according to him, was explosive energy with a pure pop structure. He also credits Australian hitmakers the Easy Beats and also the Creation with originating the sound and feel. ¶¶ Shaw goes on to talk about a subset of power pop, which he calls pop rock, which he traces back to bands like the Zombies, the Hollies, and the Searchers.
I can feel a new expression on my face. I can feel a glowing sensation taking place.
Shaw says pop rock was by nature commercial, but in the hands of this or that exceptional group sometimes approached the splendor of power pop. He cites examples like Roy Wood's band The Move. Shaw also mentions early Apple signees Badfinger, and if you're familiar with Badfinger, you know that Pete Ham was an absolute genius.
No one knows it, no one knows it.
When discussing pop rock, Shaw also talks about Michael Brown's post-Left Banke Band Stories, whose second album, About Us, from 1973, is amazing. Shaw also talks about a group called the Hudson Brothers, three brothers who had a TV variety show and put out some great records in the 70s. Side note, Bill Hudson is Kate Hudson's dad.
Hey, hey. dances.
Shaw, of course, also mentions Big Star in that article, a band that's constantly credited with practically inventing power pop, which, although they were a great band, might be overstating their influence, I think. Shaw also mentions another cool band called Blue Ash, whose 1973 album, No More and No Less, is a classic. But the pop rock band that Shaw reserves his highest praise for is Cleveland's The Raspberries. Shaw calls them a perfect band and the essence of power pop. And it's true, those first two Raspberries records especially, both released in 1972, were obviously highly influential on the genre. To Shaw, the Raspberries defined the power pop ideal, which he described as pop rock dealing with themes of innocence but without schmaltz. I take that to mean a sort of a quaint 70s version of teen angst, really. For Shaw, a band like the Raspberries used the power of pure rock and roll, as he describes it, to give force to the emotions being conveyed. By pure rock and roll, I'm guessing he means simple, basic, unpretentious, back to basics, not trying to reinvent the wheel, just straightforward with heart. Shaw discussed the Cleveland 70s rock scene that spawned the Raspberries in that 78 issue of Bomp, including the pre-Raspberries band The Choir, which featured all three of the four Raspberries, all the Raspberries except for Eric Carmen, who had his own band, Cyrus Erie, at the time. I'd say that the Choir's 1966 single, It's Cold Outside, is quintessential early power pop.
Well, my world used to be sunny, and jokes used to be funny, but now you're gone, and everything's turned all around. To be warm, and then there was a storm, but now you're gone, and everything's turned upside down. And now it's cold outside, and the rain is pouring down, and the leaves are turning brown. Can you see?
And while referencing that Cleveland scene, 70s rock scene that spawned the Raspberries, Shaw also mentions a really great three-song EP that came out in 1977 by Don Criss on his own record label, Carrot Records. Another cool band that came out of that 70s Cleveland rock scene was a band called Circus, who had a minor hit with a single called Stop, Wait, and Listen, and they released a self-titled album in 1973 that's really hard to find. In that same issue of Bomp, there's an article where Shaw discusses Dwight Twilley and the Ramones, and he claims that, quote, these two acts have the greatest potential to become gigantic stars over the next 2 years. Of course, that never happened, the gigantic star bit, for either band. The Ramones would release End of the Century, and I think personally, they kind of made a mistake going that Phil Spector route with their music. And the Dwight Twilley band had a big hit in 76 with I'm on Fire, but they weren't able to keep that momentum going. They had a real pitfall when the record label shelved their next single. It was a song called Shark, and at the time Jaws was the biggest thing in the world, the movie, and the record label decided that Shark would be considered a novelty song trying to cash in on the success of Jaws, so they shelved it. And the Dwight Twilley band, which was made up of Dwight Twilley and Phil Seymour, you will hear more about Phil Seymour on future episodes, but that band they released another great album in 77 called Twilly Don't Mind, but didn't get much attention for it. And then Phil Seymour and Dwight Twilly split up. And in 79, right after this article that Shaw wrote, Twilly released a great album just called Twilly, but he did not become a gigantic star because of it. Eventually, Shaw gets around to, in that 1978 issue of Bomp magazine about power pop, he gets around to talking about bands that were surfacing then in 1978 playing power pop, like The Shoes and The Romantics. And he also mentions two bands that bring us to where I want to begin as far as just playing songs and taking us through the development of power pop itself as the genre that was exploding in the late 70s. Two of the earliest bands doing it were the Nerves in L.A. and the Poppies in New York. And both bands, when they split up, spawned multiple great bands out of the original band. The Nerves self-released a four-song EP in 1976, and it's a mind-blowing record. You might recognize the first song. I'm in the phone with this one across the hall. The Nerves consisted of Jack Lee on guitar, Peter Case on bass, and Paul Collins on drums. Jack Lee wrote and sang Hanging on the Telephone, and he also wrote and sang a second song on the four-song EP called Give Me Some Time.
Just a word between us, and now you wanna go home. You've given up on me now, so I'll stay here on my own.
The rhythm section of the Nerves, Peter Case and Paul Collins, also wrote and sang one song each on the record. Peter's song is called When You Find Out.
I try to explain, but you don't see. No one can give you more.
Down when you find.
And the Paul Collins song on the four-song Nerves EP from 1976. This is the drummer of the band, Paul Collins. His song's called Working Too Hard.
I'm working too hard, working too hard. Be the kind of man that you want. I'm working too hard.
So when the Nerves broke up, Peter Case and Paul Collins remained together in a band for a while they called the Breakaways, but eventually they split up, and each formed his own band. Peter Case formed the Plimsolls. And drummer Paul Collins stepped out from behind the kit to front his own band, simply called The Beat. And this band is the reason that the British ska band, known for hits like Save It For Later and Mirror in the Bathroom, in America they're known as the English Beat, because Paul Collins' Beat released a killer, amazing record in 1979, simply called The Beat. And Jack Lee, the man responsible for Hanging on the Telephone, the guitar player from the Nerves, he released a couple solo albums in the early 80s, including an album in 1981, which was called Greatest Hits Volume 1.
Just remember the good times, baby.
The Poppies formed in New York City in 1973, and they released their first single on the label that Greg Shaw started, which he also called Bomp, in 1975. But I'm going to play a later song by the band from a 1978 single. This song is called If She Cries.
If she cries.
She cries. Tell her that she's on your mind.
When the four-member Poppies broke up, two of them, guitarist Bobby D. Waxman and bassist Patty Lorenzo, formed a band called The Boyfriends, and they released a single on Bomp Records. The other two members of the Poppies, guitarist Arthur Alexander and drummer Jet Harris, formed a band called The Sorrows. The Sorrows signed with Epic Records and in 1980 put out one of the best power pop albums, period, which is called Teenage Heartbreak. But that album, the Sorrows album, came out in 1980, so we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves a bit. So you have the Poppies, their first singles in 1975. You've got the Nerves EP in 1976. Then 1977 was really the year of punk rock. But by 1978, the power pop bands were beginning to spring up. A lot of them featuring members who were in punk bands, but started to take things in a different direction. And by 79-80... those are the insane years for the power pop genre when it just exploded. But we'll get into all of that in the next couple of episodes. I plan on just playing a shitload of songs for you guys. Obviously, you've noticed in this show, I've just played clips of the songs because I wanted to be able to fit more in. And I plan on doing that with a lot of the songs in future episodes of the show. But if you don't like that, if you'd rather just hear the complete songs, let me know. Let me know how you feel about it. I suppose the choice is between more edited songs or less full songs. So do you want to get exposed to more music or do you want to be able to hear the whole song? I guess that's the choice. Those are the two options. So let's go back to 1978, the year Greg Shaw wrote his treatise on power pop. A band called 2020 formed in 1977 in LA, and in 1978, Greg Shaw released the man's first single on his record label, Bomp Records. It's called Giving It All. Now, 2020 would go on to release an amazing self-titled debut album in 1979, and maybe we'll play something off of that in the next show. But another band I wanted to mention quick here is Shoes. They formed in 1974 in Zion, Illinois, and recorded a few albums just on their own with a four track that they just shared with friends and stuff and probably gave away at shows. But they self-released what is considered their debut LP in 77 called Black Vinyl Shoes. And Shaw picked up on the band and he released a single by the band on Bomp Records in 1978. And then the band signed with Elektra and their first major label album, Present Tense, came out in 79. But a song from that, the Shaw single was Tomorrow Night, which is on Present Tense, was re-recorded for Present Tense. That was the A-side. The B-side of the Bomp single that Shaw put out in 78 by Shoes was called OK.
OK.
And another band that Shaw released a single by in 1978 was the Romantics from Detroit. The Romantics, of course, became famous later on for a couple hit songs they had. I'm going to play my favorite song by the Romantics. It's from their second album, National Breakout. It's a song called Forever Yours.
To share with you, you never know how certain someone's gonna miss you. I'll see you around. This world is yours, it's for the taking. If you settle down, I hope it keeps your heart from breaking. I don't wanna change your mind.
Of course, the most successful power pop band at the time was a band called The Knack. The huge success of The Knack really opened the floodgates. It seemed like the label signed every power pop band they could find looking for the next Knack. Get The Knack went platinum in 2 months. It was the number one album in the country for 5 straight weeks. My Sharona was the number one single for 6 straight weeks and the number one song of the entire year, 1979, according to Billboard, the Billboard charts. So that year, 1979, was ground zero for the power pop explosion. I'm not a huge fan, personally, of My Sharona, but there are some great songs on that album, Get the Knack.
Saw your face from a window. Now I can't let it go. Say what I want to. When I'm trying to catch your eye, you're stepping out of her view. It's hard to do. It's such a shame. I can't get through without your number or your name.
Now Now we're getting to the point where I'm just going to bombard you with bands and songs. I'm going to spread that out over a couple more episodes. I'm not going to put a lot of thought into the order necessarily of this what I play. I'm just going to play you a bunch of my favorite power pop songs, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. So that'll be coming up in the next couple of episodes. I'm not exactly sure when the next episode will be up. A couple weeks maybe, maybe more. We'll see what happens. So find the show on Facebook. It's facebook.com/rockandorrollpodcast. So that has two R's in it there. It's rock and, then or roll, O-R-R-O-L-L, or roll, podcast. There's also a blog page, rockandorrollpodcast.blogspot.com, and there's a link to the Facebook page there. So like the Facebook page, and then you'll be able to keep tabs on what's happening. I'll update the Facebook page when the shows are up, etc., and keep tabs on the blog. I'll do the same there. Also, you can email me at rockandorrollpodcast@gmail.com. Send me an email. There's a link. Well, the email's on the blog page. I'd love to hear from you. So that's it for the first episode of Rock and or Roll, the podcast. I hope I didn't bore you too much. I hope I didn't say too many times. I hope that you enjoyed it. And I realize this first episode might have seemed kind of like a lecture. I wanted to lay out the history of power pop. And I used a lot of Greg Shaw because he came up with the term power pop. He wrote a great articles in that 1978. That issue of Bump I kept referencing is March 1978. It's got a famous cover with a guy in a yellow suit. Maybe you could find that on eBay if you're interested. It's a great magazine, great read, lots of great articles in there. So check it out if you're interested. Keep tabs on that on eBay, Bump Magazine. And so until next time, hope you liked it. Thanks for listening. And now to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with my favorite song from The Knack. It's a cut off their second album, but the little girls understand. It's called It's You. Thanks again for listening.